Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the ACE CPT manual. Specifically, we're going over chapter 6. My name is Eddie Lester, and we are here to learn about building rapport in the initial investigation stage, which is from chapter 6, right here on page 110. So, just to intro this chapter is probably the longest chapter we've seen so far. Meaning that this lecture might be a little bit longer than others. I may try to go through it a little bit faster as there's a lot of topics that just don't need to be covered in detail. So I can just kind of mention them and go through that sort of thing. But there are going to be about 15 or so test questions that come from this chapter, which I'm going to point out as we get through this and kind of teach you how to understand them in order to apply them. So looking over on the left-hand column of page 110, you kind of see what we're going to be going over. And once again, guys, we're getting back into the ACE really likes to talk about how to interact with the client. A lot of the interaction, in my opinion, that you are going to do with your clients is based on your personality. But they want to give you the edge as far as, you know, what should you do, how should you talk, how should you dress, how should you be professional, how should you act, and they want to ensure that you understand what it takes, we'll say, from a professional communication and personable standpoint to be successful as a personal trainer. So, on the left-hand side, you see the facilitation of change and motivational interviewing, health risk appraisal. We go over some medications, some assessments, how to choose the right assessments. They just kind of list the little outline of this chapter. And I want to start by reminding you of chapter 3, in which they go over the four kind of stages of working with a client. Remember, we start off in the rapport stage, followed up with the investigation stage, into the planning stage, and then finally the action stage. So that's kind of the way that they recommend working to get clients and then plan for them and then create the programs that take them to their goals. So this is kind of falling right into that sort of those stages of working with the client. So specifically they're focusing on rapport and the investigation stage, which are the first two stages, which I kind of feel like we hit already pretty well in chapter 3, but let's go ahead and dive a little bit deeper as ACE recommends. All right, so once again, we're going to define rapport there at the bottom of page 110, and the trainer, or yeah, sorry, the rapport is just going to be developing the relationship, developing trust within that client-trainer relationship. In a sense that you are making an effort to prove to that client that you care about their well-being, and they trust that and things of that nature. So, and they say, as discussed in chapter 3, rapport implies the relationship. This is over to page 111. Trust, harmony, and emotional affinity. Of course, be yourself. That's always what I recommend. And take tips from here, but use them to how you can use them to be better. Don't necessarily try to put these on for show, we'll say. They talk about empathy, once again, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, seeing the world how they see the world, to empathize with them. Warmth is just literally caring, more or less. Respect for them, and just, being genuinely warm. I guess I don't need to go too much more into detail into that. And then obviously genuine, being a genuine person in the sense that people can see through if you are trying to be something that you're not. So just be yourself once again. All right. And then they go into the key concept about rapport. Once again, the rapport stage, the investigation stage, the planning stage, and the action stage. That's what we went over in chapter 3. And rapport is about building the relationship. Investigation is learning about the client. We're going to talk a lot about that in this chapter. What are their behaviors? What's their willingness to change? What's their medical background? What do they do for fun? What's their interest? What's their attitudes? What's their lifestyle preferences? And Yeah, just understanding everything about them in order to assist yourself in, or assist them in motivating them to achieve their goals and create the appropriate behavioral program and fitness program for them to be successful. Then planning, okay? We'll get into that in a later down the road chapter. But planning is basically discussing goal setting and you know, thinking about what the program should consider as far as variables, and then also you know, motivation and behavioral change strategies are important in the planning stage. And then action, they're talking about saying or committing to complete the exercise program, listening and, you know, learning from the instructor, implement the strategies that you determine during the planning stage, and that will promote adherence. And then just tweaking the program to monitoring their overall goals and their path towards getting to their goals. All right, moving over to page 112. They talk a little bit more here about the type of work, in the sense that more about rapport, more about basically you want to understand the communication skills necessary to take a client through all of these stages. So bottom of page 112, they're going to get into a few bullet points. They first talk about the environment. Okay. You need a trainer. You got to be in the environment and where you can meet people. Okay. The way that most of the time it is in a gym area or in a comfortable setting, you know, a social setting. Sometimes a party or event can be a good social setting to meet people. You know, avoid areas of high traffic, they say, where members might not be engaged. Face a client, and then also be attentive to your appearance, to the trainer's appearance. Okay, we already kind of went over that before in prior chapters. And then effective communication. Once again, we talked about communication, verbal and nonverbal. This is all a review from chapter 3, but they just once again wanted to put it in here again. One thing I do want to point out is specifically the distance and orientation, or the body positioning. I want you to highlight that check mark on page 112, because you want to always make sure that you maintain an appropriate distance to respect the client's personal space. And specifically, they recommend staying about 1.5 to 4 feet away. Okay, there's standing too far away and they're standing too close. You definitely don't want to be too close, for sure, as that is an invasion of their personal space and might lead to them feeling uncomfortable. Okay, that typically can be asked on the test, so I definitely want you to know that, you know, always respect their personal space. That is something important. You know, if a client is kind of backing away from you, you definitely want to take note of that, and then maybe even take a step back yourself, just to make sure that their personal space is respected. All right, and that might be the way that it shows up on the test. All right, posture and position. Once again, sitting upright, maybe a slight forward lean, mirroring and gesturing. Obviously, using your I'll give my recommendation around this is you need to match the energy of what the client's bringing. Obviously, if the client's kind of like scared and hesitant and like kind of quiet and that sort of thing, if you come in and be like, "Hey, what's going on? My name's Eddie. I'm here to take you through this workout today," and they're like, "Oh, okay, yeah, that sounds great," and you continue to stay up on that high level with a lot of energy, and they're the opposite, it's not going to go well. So mirroring, when I think of mirroring, I really think of find out what they're giving to you, respect it, acknowledge it, and then give them something similar back. It can be more positive, but you know, give them something that matches their energy. That's what I always say. And gesturing, if people are you know, relaxed, you can be relaxed. If people are, we'll say, you know, excited and using their hands a lot, you can do the same. You know, just obviously don't fidget. Kind of talked about that prior as well. And then the, you know, we'll go to, and this is kind of, nonverbal communication. as well as like eye contact, facial expressions, smile, make eye contact, obviously. Voice quality as you get into more verbal communication. You want to talk about, we'll say, you know, the tone of your voice. And yeah, don't have a weak voice, more or less. Kind of mentioned this before. And then listening effectively is probably the most important thing on here. They kind of say that an effective communicator definitely listens more than they speak. And that's because they want to understand what the person is saying so that they can respond to it. Fun facts with ACE right here is that they say that humans can speak 125 to 250 words per minute, but they're capable of listening up to 500 words per minute, which is why you can put my audio lectures on fast forward and I can be a high voice squeaky guy, and you could probably comprehend just as much. Maybe not, but hey, try that and shoot me an email and see if it works for you. All right, fun times with Eddie. There you go. Anyways, all right. Yes, make sure that you listen effectively. That's at the bottom there. And another key concept, which they do bring this up a lot on just in general throughout the ACES program, is empathy. They talk about being empathetic, and one of the reasons why I suggest being empathetic is to attempt to see the world in their eyes so that you can sell them what they are seeing, if that makes sense. If somebody's seeing weight loss goal and they see that it's there and attainable, you need to recognize that and be able to sell them that, their belief in that, if that makes sense. We get into that once again a lot in our continuing education course for business and sales. Check that out in the continuing education tab above. And definitely when you're ready for your CEUs, you can try out that course. Highly, highly recommended to be successful as a trainer. But empathy, just be aware of their emotional patterns. Be conscious of their cultural and ethnic differences. And this is kind of all just another repeat from chapter 3. But and then also make sure that you are, just aware of the way of what you're saying, in the sense to make sure it's not offensive and doesn't cross any cultural boundaries, gender boundaries, things like that. All right, moving over to page 114, we're going to get into some new stuff, some interviewing techniques, okay? These are great ways to encourage the client is motivated, encourage them to talk, and also ensure that you understand. So let's go over these check marks here all on page 114, and I'm going to tell you to highlight a few because that a few of them do show up on the test for sure, because ACE loves to talk about the interview process to assist you in getting clients. So there's a variety of interviewing techniques. The first one we're going to start with is minimal encouragers. And these are going to be words that are going to encourage the client to share more information. The example they give is, or what do you mean by knee pain? That's kind of what they say. Or, you mentioned that your niece is, or you need to pick your niece up from work. I don't know why I said that, or pick your niece up from school. But just encourage them to talk more about themselves by asking for a further explanation. It's an encourager. Paraphrasing, respond to the client's communication by restating the essence of their content, okay, which is a little bit different than reflecting, which we're going to get into down below. Probing, I want you to highlight this one. It's asking additional questions to gather more information. I also call this digging, with a shovel to find the deeper meaning for the reasoning behind their motivations. Probing is the best way to uncover the deepest motivations they have around exercise. Because somebody may say, I want to lose weight to look good. Okay, and then you might ask, as a probing question, well, why do you want to look good? And then they're going to have a story, maybe something like, I've always been overweight. Okay, always being overweight, did that cause a lot of issues? And then they may say, yeah, I was always made fun of. So then all of a sudden, as opposed to I want to lose weight to look good, it's I was made fun of my entire life, and that's why, or I'm looking to gain confidence from exercising. in my physical appearance. So that's where it kind of is it's a major difference, and asking probing questions really helps you uncover the deeper meaning and allows you to sell more to what the client's motivations are. That's why I like to bring that up, because the selling aspect, because once again, guys, you are salespeople. You will be selling, and in order to make money as a personal trainer, you have to sell effectively, and to get lots of clients and make the money you want to make, you have to be, have lots of clients. Go team. All right. Once again, plug for my business and sales course, or our business and sales course right at the top. I do teach that whole thing and really set up my thoughts around the personal or the sales process in personal training. So check that out for sure. All right. Once again, highlight reflecting. That's the next one on page 114, the check mark. And this is going to be, they specifically say, restating the feelings of what the speaker means, but within different words. Okay. So that's, and they typically on the test want you to know a statement. Okay. So the example they give is, I hear you say you've been unsuccessful at losing weight, but it appears that it makes you uncomfortable to discuss your previous attempts at weight loss. Okay, that's the example that they give. Another example for reflecting would be like, so you want to gain muscle and you really want to do that before summer so that you could look good on the beach. Okay, that's a small reflection that just ensures that you understood what they're talking about, and also displays empathy and understanding, they mention. And I want you guys to understand how you might create a reflecting statement that ensures understanding, as that is the way that it will show up on the test. They'll have quote, and this will say, this is an example of which of the following interview techniques. Boom, boom, reflecting. Okay. Clarifying is next. Clarifying exactly what it sounds like. You're just clarifying, confirming that you understood what they said by, just verifying, asking them, is this what you mean? Okay. Informing is basically educating. It's the same thing. It's when they tell you about an issue that they're having and you give them a small tip that can, they can use to, address that issue. Okay. They give an example there about asthma, and confronting is next. Using mild to strong feedback with the client. So confronting is, it depends on your personality. I'm not a big confronter. I'm not going to go, say, well, the reason why you're overweight is because you've been eating like crap. Here, look at all the food you told me you've been eating. That's confronting. It's directly calling them out on the issues that they're having to motivate them. Some people it works with, other people's, it'll turn them off right away and they'll be gone. So be careful with confronting. But if it's your personality to really be upfront about the reasoning behind why someone might not be successful, then that, go for it. Run with it. That's awesome. When people confront me, I typically am very responsive to that and be like, you know what, you're probably right, and then I can analyze it myself a little bit further. So that's just being open minded and be aware of the open minded people versus the closed minded people that might not like being confronted about their goal or their issue or their lack of success. Questioning, just asking questions. That's about all I need to say about that one. Deflecting, you can kind of change the focus of something onto another item, and it's not recommended, they say. When I think of deflecting, and or it's basically you're not acknowledging what the client is saying, or saying that you understand it, that you get it, because you're ready to tell your story about the same thing. And you have to be careful when communication. I'm sure you all have that friend that tells stories on end, on end, on end without stopping and never asks you one question. That's not a very good way to develop rapport and build the relationship with a client. Let your client talk as much as possible. Absolutely. All right. So next, we're going to get into just some basic further tips in these bullet points down here. You don't want to do certain things. You want to do certain things. They say a preaching style is judgmental. and it's more of a lecture. You're like preaching to them. An educating style is informal. I like using the educating style. It's not necessarily this is the way it is, but it's a way that you can expand their knowledge base. Counseling style is supportive. You want to kind of make sure that you don't go too far into the counseling style, but definitely you want to listen to them in that counseling style and, you know, don't necessarily give them advice outside of your scope of practice, like around other things outside of fitness, but a counseling style can be used for, oh, you know, when you're out there on the gym floor and it's crowded, you can always go to this area and do this type of workout. Just mix it up. Give them advice about an issue they're having around fitness, not so much other areas though. And then a directing style is more instructive. You're providing instruction and direction, and just an educating style more or less. Okay, so 115, they're going to talk about the expand your knowledge section, asking the right pre-exercise interview questions. The right pre-exercise interview questions, in my opinion, are the ones that really connect with the client and get them to think about their life. and it really gets to know them, and they can open up a little bit. Obviously, depending on your style as your personality, you may not want to get deep with people. But my goal with each person is to get them to understand that you know, committing to something like fitness is more than just I'm gonna go to the gym and work out. It's a lot of life experience that they have that will motivate them to show up or might not. And I want to know all about it, as well as then asking the right questions to learn all about that is important. They give a ton of examples on the right questions. We call these our power questions. And have a lot more ones that are geared towards making sales in our business and sales course. But they talk about, you know, tell me about a typical week in your life. What types of physical activities are part of your daily routine? And all of these you can follow up with and probe in and get deeper and deeper to find further understanding and meaning behind these questions. Obviously, you want to know if they have pain. What do they do for fun? You know, where do they vacation? What's their favorite movie? You know, do you work outdoors? And what's your thoughts and feelings around fitness in general? Obviously, you can ask questions based on the way that you're feeling with the client, but have a list of questions like this available to you during the interviewing process in order to promote, or to make sure that you hit most of the questions that you need for sure. All right, so next, we're going to be talking about facilitating change and motivational interviewing. After you have developed a relationship, you can kind of start to talk with the client more and start to understand a little bit more about their behaviors and potential items that can change their behaviors, or you can recognize patterns that of their behaviors that might not be conducive to their goals. Okay, so you want to identify their readiness to change, and that's what they kind of talk about there with the trans-theoretical model. And as we move over to page 116, they're going to talk a little bit about something called motivational interviewing. And motivational interviewing is going to be a way to get them excited about exercising by asking them questions. And yeah, they talked about that motivational interviewing in chapter 3, so we don't need to go too much into it, but basically just understand asking them questions and you know, basically the way that I do this sometimes is having them remember a specific time in which they enjoyed exercising and kind of, you know, getting them pumped up to get that feeling again around exercising. And it's not just about asking questions. It's just basically you really want to have a strategy around your question asking to get them to a point of motivation. And that does take skill and a lot of practice. And they do kind of talk about the motivational, you know, interviewing a little bit more in chapter 3, so you can kind of go back and check that out a little bit more. But next, as we get down to figure 6-1, they're looking to show you a good way to understand where someone is in their willingness to change a specific behavior. And you know, when your clients come into the gym, that's kind of the reason they're coming into the gym to meet with you and meeting with personal trainers, because they want to change a behavior. They want to exercise more, you know, feel healthier by that exercising more, maybe potentially change their eating habits. So you want to look at their, or you can use this readiness to change questionnaire, which is figure 6-1 at the bottom of page 116, to ask them questions and determine where they are in their readiness to change. So some sample questions is, and these are also kind of power questions in my opinion. You really want to find out like, hey, are you ready to make this change? Have you ever tried doing this change before? What do you perceive as the risks to making this change? That's a good one. And are you committed to making this change, even though it may be challenging? And are there any other reasons why you want to change this behavior? So there's those certain things can be great power questions to understand. When somebody tells you their goal and where they want to be, and you tell them what it's going to take, you asking them these questions is a great way, in my opinion, to also increase the motivational interviewing aspect, because someone's going to get pumped up. It's like, are you ready to make this change? It's like, well, yes, I am. I'm definitely ready. And then you make them think. You say, what do you perceive as the risk to doing this change? And they're gonna be like, whoa, I've never really thought about the risks. And you know, someone might say that, what if I fail? Failure is huge with a lot of these people looking to make a behavioral change. It's like, what if I fail? It's like, well, then you fail. Then you're right back where you are now. but yeah, it's a motivational interviewing technique that can get them kind of excited to work out for sure, as well as determine their readiness to make a change. All right, goal setting and rapport, top page 117, they talk about how you want to perform goal setting and build trust in them at the same time. So you want to create conversation, and a lot of times with the rapport element to goal setting, what I do is really focus on when they tell me their goal, I want to know all about their goal. I want to know if... you know, why they want to achieve it, and not just the surface reason like I kind of mentioned, but I want to probe and I want to dig deep to find out their true motivation underneath that goal. And once I have that true motivation underneath that goal, I want to ask them questions about it to really help them connect and trust that they're working towards something that they really want and that they love in a way. Hey, love, use the big L-O-V-E word on this. This is great. All right, moving to the middle of page 117 and the health risk appraisal. This is the start, in my opinion, of the interviewing process. So they kind of talked about, you know, the buildup towards the interviewing process, but most of the time you're just building rapport, and then you get into a room when the client has agreed to a free assessment or a free, you know, fitness consultation, you can call it. And the first thing you're going to do is start off with health risk appraisals. You want to make sure that all the medical history and potential issues are upfront and they're stated first so that you know how quickly you can move with this client. Okay? So as you get down, we're going to talk about, the key concept there talks about the purpose of the health screens. And you want to know about any diseases. You want to know if there's any injuries or risks from any health conditions or contraindications like medications. Find out if there's any people that are at risk. And then you basically want to make sure that the person isn't going to have an immediate issue from working out once or twice with you. And they have a whole system of doing that we're going to get into in just a second. So as we flip over to page 118, we're going to talk about the first step to any fitness consultation, which is giving them or allowing them to fill out what's called the PAR-Q. PAR-Q stands for Physical Activity Readiness Questionnaire, and I want you to highlight that on page 118, and I want you to know exactly what the PAR-Q is, as it can be a test question. And what it is a minimal yet safe pre-exercise screening measure to determine if someone has, we'll say, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, metabolic disease, or anything that's directly hindering them working out immediately. So specifically, yeah, so basically, if the main thing with the ParkU does is it's a yes or no questionnaire, which is on page 119, just to the right there. And if you notice these seven questions, there's a yes and no question. And if somebody answers yes on any question to the ParkU, they must talk to a doctor and get a doctor's approval before they can work out with you. Because if they answer yes, it means that they potentially could have an issue around exercising immediately at a moderate, low to moderate level. Okay, it's not a super detailed questionnaire. It just basically says, hey, can you work out today without much risk? Yes. Yes or no. If they answer yes to any question, though, they have to go get a doctor's release. And yeah, pretty simple. As we kind of go down there, the I want to talk really quickly about, or yeah, so furthermore, the ParkU is really about determining the presence of cardiovascular, pulmonary, or metabolic disease. These are these bullet points at the bottom middle of 118. Determining the absence, or making sure that there is absence of cardiovascular risk factors, and then also the absence of sign or symptoms, that may lead to that. So, what is the purpose of the ParkQ and of a risk stratification? So, ParkQ and health history questionnaire are kind of in this risk stratification spectrum, or that's what you're doing, is you're determining the risk that somebody has when you don't know them and they're coming straight into you. And it's really to determine the presence of heart issues and specifically cardiovascular issues, metabolic issues, and pulmonary issues. So I want you to know that. I want you to highlight that. What is the ParkQ do? Could be a test question. All right. And it also says that the risk stratification is going to be important because, you know, someone with one positive risk factor will be treated differently than someone with several positive risk factors. And we're going to get into that as we get down the road here. I believe it's, on the next page. And this risk stratification does show up on the test, so let's talk a little bit more about it. But the three steps that we can highlight, three bullet points at the bottom of page 118 is there's three steps that should be followed chronologically. You need to determine if there's CAD risk factors, which is coronary artery disease. And then you need to perform a risk stratification based on those CAD risk factors. And then determine if there is need for a doctor's release or medical exam. And then if there is, you need medical clearance to start exercising with this person. So, they talk about table 6-1, which is basically the clinical relevant CAD health risk factors. I believe that is right there on the following page, which we're going to get into because that's going to be really important for the test. You want to look at each of these risk factors in 6-1, and I want you to memorize all of them. We aren't quite there yet. I want to just point out some of the questions on the ParkQ first. We'll talk about that once we get to it. So on page 119, ParkQ, you can read through this, but the main thing are the seven questions. What do they determine if somebody has a risk for cardiovascular, metabolic, or pulmonary disease? And you can read through those seven questions. What happens when you answer yes to one or more? You need a doctor's release. Okay, hopefully that's ingrained in your head. And you want to talk to your doctor before becoming physically active. If they answer yes, make sure there is a release, typically in writing or email or even a phone call. I'd say to protect yourself legally, you want a doctor's note in writing. Because let's say they say, oh yeah, this person's fine, and they end up having a heart attack on your first workout, and they answered yes to any ParkQ questions, and you don't have physical proof that of a doctor's note, that could be on you legally, and you might get in trouble, sued, that sort of thing. All right, anyways, moving over to page 120. Sorry to be a Debbie Downer there. Table 6-1 on page 120 is going to be the risk factors from ACSM, American College of Sports Medicine, and the thresholds that determine if they are risk factors or not. Okay. All right, so you need to know the guidelines of all of these, as they can ask a question with 13 different parts, and you need to determine how many total risk factors there are. Okay, so once again, memorize the entire 6-1 table. All right, and then also you're going to need to understand the table 6-3, not as a direct test question, but you can kind of, or I'll explain that in a second. Anyways, age is a risk factor, just being older for men over the age of 45, for women over the age of 55. You add a positive risk factor for family history. A sudden death of from heart attack, myocardial infarction, before 55 of a father or first-degree male relative, or before the age of 65 in a mother or first-degree female relative. That's another positive risk factor. Cigarette smoking, specifically, pay attention, current cigarette smoker who quit within the previous 6 months. So if somebody smoked a pack a day a year ago, it's not a positive risk factor. But if they are current smokers, or they haven't quit for more than 6 months, that is a positive risk factor. Keep that in mind, as they can be tricky. They could say, oh yeah, I used to smoke a pack a day 7 months ago, and it's not a positive risk factor, so be careful there. Sedentary lifestyle is a positive risk factor. If they don't exercise for 30 minutes a day, 3 days a week, then that is a positive risk factor. Obesity, a body mass index of 30 or higher, we'll get into that in further chapters. To go over the exact classifications, but yeah, BMI is body mass index, and that is a if you have a BMI in the obese range, which is over 30, that is a positive risk factor. I want you to highlight that body mass index of 30 or more. Hypertension, what is the threshold for high blood pressure, which is hypertension? Systolic blood pressure is anything larger than 140. Diastolic blood pressure is less than or more than or equal to 90. Okay, so 140 over 90, if it's higher than that, even one of those numbers, it is a positive risk factor. Highlight that. Dyslipidemia. Cholesterol. If your HDL is less than 40, which is good cholesterol, HDL is good cholesterol. I consider it healthy, dense lipoproteins. That's the way I memorize healthy for good in HDL. If it's less than 40, that is a positive risk factor. Okay, if they have a HDL of 38, that means they get a positive risk factor. Highlight that one specifically. And then also a total serum cholesterol of more than 200 is also a positive risk factor. So if it's 198, that's fine, no risk factor. If it's 202, that is a positive risk factor. You definitely want you to highlight those two that I just mentioned. You can also note that anything greater than 130, the number 130 milligrams per deciliter, mg/dl, is going to be, for LDL cholesterol, is going to be a positive risk factor. So one of those three means that you get a positive risk factor if you fall into any of those categories. And then for prediabetes, fasting plasma glucose of greater than 100, okay, milligrams per deciliter again. And that's a fasting plasma glucose. It's like you drink 50 grams of sugar in like a juice form, and then you wait an hour and test your plasma glucose. That's what it is, like a glucose tolerance test. And that is a positive risk factor as well. One thing that you also may want to note, I'm pretty sure they don't try to trick you with this one, but if their HDL cholesterol is above 60, that's a good thing, and it's a negative risk factor, which you won't see that too often, that it goes to negative points, meaning there's one less risk factor because they are healthier in the cholesterol spectrum. All right, that took a good amount of time to go through all of that, but table 6.1, listen to that again, and you want to know the guidelines for the positive risk factors in order to determine the total number of points for, you know, a paragraph's worth of information given to you from a client. And there's a sample of this, I believe, on a future page. I think it's further down the road. All right, next is the risk classification. So what happens when somebody has one risk factor? Okay. One risk factor, according to the top left of figure 6-3 on page 121, is low risk. Less than two risk factors. Okay, that's low risk. And then they say no medical exams needed all the way through. Moderate risk is if they have two risk factors or more, but they don't have any known symptoms, meaning a moderate risk is like you have two or more risk factors, and then you're a moderate risk, okay? And then you would need a medical exam for vigorous activity, okay? And then high risk, so just to be clear, you're only high risk if you have a known symptom of cardiorespiratory, pulmonary, renal, or metabolic disease. So let's say somebody has every single risk factor on here, but they aren't diagnosed with any, and then don't have any diagnosed symptoms of an issue. They're moderate risk until they have a known issue in which they become high risk, in which they need a medical supervision, they need an exercise test, and a doctor's clearance to exercise. Woo! Good times. Okay. Moving on to page 122, let's talk a little bit further about this key concept up here. And so you as a personal trainer do not have the training to diagnose any of these conditions. Once again, if it's outside of your scope of practice to attempt to say, oh, you might have renal failure, you might have diabetes, you might have certain things like that. Leave that to the qualified licensed professionals. That's that first kind of paragraph to choose or to diagnose those issues. Okay. I don't know too many personal trainers that are trying to jump out and say, oh, you might have a heart murmur. You might have tachycardia. You might have intermittent claudication. Okay. Most trainers don't jump out there and do that, but just note that it's not in your scope of practice. And specifically, guys, if somebody has any of these bullet points down here, they need to see a doctor before they can exercise again. Specifically, highlight a heart murmur. I want you to highlight ankle edema and dizziness or syncope. Okay, because those could be a test question, and you would definitely want to make sure that if you recognize that somebody has a known heart murmur, you definitely don't want to just be like, oh yeah, let's exercise for sure, unless they already have a doctor's release and guidelines that they should be following. Okay. All right, that's going to be it for that sort of section. Let's see if there's anything in the middle there. Nothing too important. All right, let's go ahead and move over to the evaluation forms at the bottom of page 122 and talk about the first evaluation form. So, yeah, you have your PARQ, you have your health risk assessment, you have your medical history questionnaire, that sort of thing. And then you also have your kind of, we'll say, forms that protect you a bit and ensure that the person is aware of the risks associated with exercise. And the first one, and one that I definitely want you to highlight, is called the informed consent. So the informed consent is basically proving that the person acknowledges, or your client acknowledges, that they've been informed about the risks associated with exercise and working with a personal trainer. So informed consent is basically just a legal document about a page long that says, there are high risks associated with exercise, some of which include heart attack, stroke, blah, 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 blah. And they list all these things that could possibly happen, and the person needs to sign it. Most people don't even read it, and they just sign it and say, yeah, okay, I understand there's risks associated with exercise. That's it. It doesn't provide any sort of protection. It just allows the person to be confirm that they were informed of the health risks, so that if something happens, they can't say, oh, they never told me that could happen. And it protects you a little bit more in a court of law. It doesn't provide any strong legal evidence or we'll say legal support, but if they acknowledge it, at least then they weren't completely unaware and the trainer did his job, more or less. All right, so next. Oh, yeah, it basically says that, what's going to be happening, the risks associated with it, the procedures, maybe the purposes of some of the assessments, And it's not a liability waiver, meaning it does not provide legal immunity. Highlight that too. Informed consent just acknowledges that they recognize the risks associated with exercise, period. Good. Potential test question there. And then also a release of liability more or less releases the trainer from being held responsible in every situation except negligence. And in order to prove negligence, there it needs to be a very specific thing that the trainer did not do that then led to an issue. Like the trainer knew that a piece of equipment was broken and still performed an exercise on that piece of equipment. The person fell, got severely injured, and that was the trainer's fault because they shouldn't have been exercising on broken equipment. Okay, so the release liability protects you legally, but not from like negligence. All right, moving down. Oh yeah, and also they always say definitely consult a lawyer in order to draw up a appropriate legal liability waiver or release a liability waiver for your state, because every state's got slightly different laws, so make sure that yours complies with your state. Most of the time you can just Google release a liability personal trainer California or Wisconsin or New York, and you could get something that actually was drawn up from a lawyer that you can use. All right, next, health history questionnaire. Yeah, that's kind of important. I typically give that right along with the PARQ, so that I get to know any potential issues associated with their health. And the specific components of the health history questionnaire are going to be things like physical activity information, medications, that's important, injuries, illnesses, surgeries, pain, you know, family, medical history, and then specifically lifestyle information. And lifestyle information I want you to highlight because lifestyle information is going to be, you know, what they do on a daily basis. What is their stress levels like? Okay, highlight stress. What are their what is their sleep like? What is their work like? Are there any obstacles around performing an activity? You know, what do they see as the barriers to getting to the gym or performing an activity? So, what is their current lifestyle like? I want you to highlight that one around the health history questionnaire, as it could be a test question. All right, now let's go into the exercise history and attitude questionnaire. Yeah, not too often given, but just you know, talk to them about their previous exercise history and their attitude towards it. If they've worked with a personal trainer before, did they enjoy it? Did they not enjoy it? That sort of thing. Medical release. This is going to be from a doctor. And yeah, basically it gives the doctor an opportunity to provide some guidelines for that individual. And then testing forms, which we're going to get into on the next few pages. And also in chapter 7 and 8, they talk about testing forms. But that's going to be to record the data of all of your assessments that you're going to be doing. And also could have some instructions on how to perform those assessments. All right, moving over to page 124, 125, 126, and 127. There's going to be some forms here. I don't need to go over these too much with you. They're samples of a health history questionnaire. They're samples of a exercise history questionnaire. Page 126, they're samples of the continuation of that exercise history and attitude questionnaire. A sample of a medical release form, and all of that's just kind of a sample that you can use. I'm sure you could probably download those on the ACE website somehow. Let's see if they give instructions. Yeah, ACE, or on the 123 right-hand column, visit acefitness.org/PT resources to download these few items. And you could change these as you'd like as well, since they aren't legally binding documents. Okay, 128, we're going to talk about a risk stratification example. Okay, this can be a direct test question right here. They could give you this entire chart and say, "Tell me the positive risk factors." Okay, typically it's given in a paragraph form, but let's kind of go over it really quick to determine what is a positive and or not positive risk factor. So as opposed to the bullet points, we'll go straight to the chart there. And so age, this person is 49 years old. Are they a male? Yes. Okay. I guess we should have read that up above. But Joe is his name, and he's a male. And Joe is 49 years old. Is that a positive risk factor? Defining criteria in comments, it says yes, it is, because greater than 45 years old is a positive risk factor for males. So yes. Is he a smoker? One pack a day. So he smokes. Did he quit in the last 6 months? No, he did not. He currently smokes. So that is a positive risk factor. Is he physically active? No, he's not. He's sedentary. That is a positive risk factor. Does he have hypertension? He almost does, but look at those numbers. They're under the 140 over 90. So therefore, no, that is not a positive risk factor. His HDL, is it below 40? No, it's above 40, so it's 41 milligrams per deciliter, so that's not a positive risk factor. But his LDL is over the threshold, which is 130, so that is a positive risk factor. Hopefully you're following along with me in this chart. Then his impaired fasting glucose, is that over 100? No, it was at 98. It's close, but can't be a positive risk factor. Obesity. What's his BMI? His BMI is 33.6. Okay, that is in the obese category, therefore it is a positive risk factor. What is his total risk factors? Oh yeah, HDL is not above 60, so that means his total positive risk factors or score is 5 total risk factors. Okay, so a test question can come from any one of those. I might say, what is the total number of risk factors? Aside from the total number of risk factors, what is his classification? Is it low risk, moderate risk, or high risk? Okay, so know the difference. Remember, low risk is one risk factor or less. Moderate risk is 2 risk factors or more without being diagnosed with anything. And then high risk is being diagnosed with anything makes them high risk. Okay. All right. Glad we got to go over that right there. Let's go over to page 129. And talk about the benefits of regular physical activity. Yes, we know that regular physical activity is beneficial. Okay. And you can get injured. You can aggravate a existing condition. And you could also create a new condition. So basically, yes, regular physical activity is beneficial, but be aware of the risks. And as a personal trainer, it's your kind of job to make sure that people aren't getting injured. But it takes a good year or two to be confident in the fact that you aren't going to injure someone. Obviously, if you go really, really low and slow on the progress, you can make sure someone isn't injured. But small pains come up everywhere all the time, especially as you get into the 30 to 50 to 60-year-old population. 30 and above, 40 and above, that sort of range. All right. So they're now going to, we're getting into the health conditions that affect physical activity. We can kind of breeze through most of this, but let's quickly talk about it. Obviously, cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis can affect physical activity with this disease is beneficial, but you have to be aware that in anything that is going to put stress on the heart could cause a heart attack or myocardial infarction. And angina is going to be the symptom or precursor to a heart attack. If somebody has chest pain, angina pectoris or pectoralis, pectoral chest and angina meaning chest pain, you want to stop exercise and monitor them until it either goes away. And sometimes if it's severe chest pain, definitely call an ambulance, things like that. Especially if you know you're working with someone with those sort of, or with that diagnosed disease. A lot of people with atherosclerosis don't recognize the total degree at which they have it. Some people can have severe atherosclerosis and not know it, and that can cause a heart attack. So be aware if you're working with the older population, that is always an issue. Hypertension. Is definitely, associated with CAD. And if they have high blood pressure, it might be, need to be regulated via medicine. And if so, you need to modify the exercise program. Respiratory diseases. Okay, so you're working with someone with a respiratory disease. They can't breathe as well as a normal person. So, since they can't breathe as well as like a normal person, it's going to be important to not have the intensity be too difficult. Bronchitis, emphysema, COPD, asthma, those are examples, and be aware of that. Once again, the special populations, all of these guidelines can be found in Chapter 14, so we don't need to get too deep into them. One thing I do want to stress, though, is Bottom page 130, musculoskeletal injury, we'll say, something like injury can affect the or physical activity, definitely. Specifically, you know, you have muscles, bones, tendons, ligaments, and they all can be injured. Sprains and strains can occur, and they could be continuous, meaning they never go away because of activity, and you need to be aware of that. Things like Achilles tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, patellar tendonitis, all those sort of things are chronic, and meaning they're long-term, and they typically need to be addressed and or managed to make sure they aren't affecting and hurting activity. And specifically, what I meant to say through all of that is the fact that most of those musculoskeletal injuries come from repetitive stress. And what do I mean by repetitive stress? It means that an overuse injury has occurred. If you continually do bench press and your shoulders protract and you're tight in your chest, you're going to eventually end up with a shoulder injury. And that's from repetitive stress of bench pressing too much, and it's called an overuse injury. Okay, and that's usually the result of a poor training technique, so I want you to highlight that under overuse injury, or poor form. Okay, if you have bad form and you're exercising all the time, it's not going to be, you're not going to have a good time. All right, so yeah, other you know, sort of issues associated with the musculoskeletal system, tennis elbow, shin splints, which is your IT band syndrome, herniated disc, bursitis, tendonitis, arthritis, and then also muscle atrophy in the older population where people can lose muscle. So just be aware of those sort of things and how they can affect activity. Metabolic, yes, absolutely, can affect exercise, diabetes, and their ability to, we'll say, consume or transport glucose into the cell is affected. And they need to have their glucose meter on them if they are exercising to check, because if they feel dizzy or feel tired for any reason, they need to check their blood sugar to make sure that it's in appropriate levels. And